good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's Family Law Live. Can everybody mute if you haven't done so already, or Hannah will do that for you. If you've got any questions you want to raise, please do put them to Hannah or put them in the chat. We really do want to hear about your experiences with this, so please do put those comments in the chat. So we're lucky enough to be joined by a stellar panel tonight, which includes the co-chair of the Collaborative Working Party, which is Tasha Bevan-Stewart, and the family law legend that is James Pirrie. So welcome both.
Who has now disappeared.
James disappears as I give him the biggest compliment I can give him.
Don't be shy.
So Tasha, can I start with you by asking you to explain collaborative practice in a nutshell?
Yes. I'm assuming in the audience we've got a mix of people who have done collaborative work before and those who haven't. So apologies if I'm repeating things you already know, but hopefully most of you have an inkling of what this is about. This is a process where we meet round table with our clients and our counterpart solicitor to work out work principles through their case and to discuss both financial arrangements and child arrangements and anything else they want to deal with in the context of their separation. The process is designed to be flexible, non-confrontational, and it's conducted by solicitors according to principles of being constructive and exploring options with the clients rather than taking a stance and negotiating in a positional way. And we agree to all the principles up front and normally sign up to what's called a participation agreement, which essentially just outlines the way we're all going to work. And it's helpful for people to refer back to as we go through the process. It's a series of meetings structured so that solicitors do not have to write nasty letters back and forward to each other. That is deliberately excluded from the workings of collaborative practice, if at all possible, and we also try and minimize back and forth emails. The costs, etc., are usually agreed up front as to who is paying fees, who's paying for the divorce, who's going to initiate divorce proceedings. So from that point of view, it can be quite powerful. If you start off on the right foot, there's so much that can be agreed up front in order to start things going in the right direction before you move on to the trickier parts, normally the financial disclosure and the financial settlement itself. Can I answer any other questions about that, Fiona? Is that comprehensive enough?
Yeah, that's good. I think people want to know about how to join a pod.
Yes. So pods are set up voluntarily by groups of professionals in local areas, usually once they've done their collaborative foundation training. And there are about 45, 46 pods registered with Resolution at the moment. And no doubt there are more scattered around the country. And they're essentially practice groups that meet three, four, five times a year that consist of lawyers, mediators, family consultants, financial professionals, sometimes barristers, anyone who's involved in collaborative practice locally. And the idea is to support the practice locally, share ideas, but most importantly, to build rapport and relationships with your local colleagues so that you can set up, build cases together when clients come along to either or both of you that say, actually, I'm really interested in working in that way. It's a way of reaching out to your local colleagues to build that casework.
And on that, you mentioned experts, and I can see Adele Ballantyne's here. You can bring other experts in, can't you? I don't know whether Adele does that, but perhaps, Tasha, you can tell us a bit more about bringing in other experts.
Yes, I've worked with Adele on a case quite recently, and we, wherever possible, we involve financial experts, or what we call family consultants, who have a therapeutic background at the outset of the case, or as close to the beginning of the case as possible, and so that they can bring their expertise to bear. So financial experts kind of come in at different stages. So, for example, you might need a mortgage raising capacity report. And in my experience, we instruct jointly to prepare those. Or you might need a pension sharing report, which the clients can also instruct jointly. But where Adele's expertise might come in is perhaps if there are issues relating to children or just communication generally between the couple, she can be brought in to sit in on meetings or consult with the clients privately. Adele, I don't know if you want to add to that to explain a bit more.
Yeah, I've done a fair few now, actually, and it is really helpful. I think the first thing I want to say about the collaborative process in general is that it is such a fantastic way to conduct the divorce process. Certainly from colleague to colleague, there is a really good opportunity to form good relationships together. And when, you know, that's really important for reframing for clients, that actually here we've got two professionals who are, you know, working together for their clients' good, and that actually the solicitors are not sending horrible letters backwards and forwards, and are actually sitting and having good conversations together. That's really important as a way of leading clients into understanding that it doesn't have to be about a fight. So that's the first thing I want to say about it. The second is that certainly I'm working on a case at the moment up north, and I've seen both clients individually, and what I've learned is that, you know, both of them exhibit a certain behaviour when under stress that will trigger each other. And so what's helpful in those meetings is that when I see that behaviour starting to come out, I can highlight that, and we can calm everything down or slow everything down, so that actually that behaviour then goes away. And then we've got two clients back in the room who are listening, who are not being triggered by each other. So it tends to bring about better outcomes, because clients start listening to each other and then are more reasonable in how they're approaching decision making.
Interesting. So the title of this show today is The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. So if we're looking at the good, and can I ask you both, James and Tasha, to just tell me what you think the strengths of collaborative working is, and what types of case this can work really well? And you might have already covered some of this, but I just wanted to hear from both of you on that.
James, do you want to come in?
I wrote that, and I'm not sure I agree with it anymore, but it seemed to be brilliant when I first wrote it. I think it's quite frustrating for people trying to understand what collaborative is, because I think so many of us describe it and think of it quite differently. I'm quite interested by the Melka model, which would say really that you only do collaborative work with an Adele on board, and ideally with an IFA as well. And so therefore you're only going to go forward with a full team model. And that's certainly a sort of a pure and perfect way. And it's a very sort of stable tripod rather than the sort of pogo on which we operate, perhaps as a mediator where there's just one of us. But it's also much, much sort of broader than that. So we've all done cases just with sort of two of us, two lawyers in the room, finding a way forward. And so it's quite a broad church. I mean, it lives somewhere between the cases that can mediate and the cases that are going to go to court. And I think it's the sort of paradigm way of settling cases around a table. So of course we all do roundtable meetings, and some of them we even reach deals in. But actually, if you were trying to reach a really good deal, and if you're really trying to transform the parties' relationships for the future benefit of their kids, and if you were trying to make the most financially intelligent solution you could, you'd probably reach out for collaborative. So, let's go. Tasha.
Absolutely, I agree with all of that. And I think it applies in cases and works really well in cases where the couple are comfortable to sit in the room with each other, but they may feel that need for a bit of legal support, some on-hand legal advice. And I think what's key to emphasise in describing this is the perhaps unique or unusual feature is that the lawyers are talking to each other openly in terms of the advice that they're delivering. And so they aren't holding secrets and running around and having caucuses in back rooms the way we are with FDRs. They are actually sharing their advice and expertise, not just with their own client, but with the other spouse. And it's highly unusual and highly effective in the way that operates. And you get to know the other spouse, and seldom in cases do we have that opportunity. So you can assess perhaps what their worries are, their fears, and work with them in a way that's much more productive than setting yourself up as their enemy. And I think that's the power of this process.
Do you find that you're interpreting the spouse in a different way to your client sometimes?
You mean as what they say?
Yeah, so they might react or be triggered by something the husband's saying, but you see it completely anodyne. You know, it's not as, you know, yeah, you can see it quite neutrally.
This is where the discussions with your counterpart solicitor come in, and people like Adele and family consultants who can help with that if you run into any sticky situations there. But having that dialogue, you can constantly pull out as the two lawyers managing the process and have discussions about what you think's going on in the room. And people do that. You know, it's fantastic. The lawyers I've collaborated with, we do have debrief meetings after the sort of wider session, the 4 or 5 way meetings, as we call them, and pick up the phone to each other to discuss how we think things should go in the next meeting. So it
changes all the relationships, doesn't it, really, in that? You know, I think it's very easy to caricaturise the sort of other partner, just as the parties are sort of demonising the lawyers, and round and round it goes, really. I mean, my other bit of good, I thought, was to share that bit, that I think the bit that Collaborative has been so successful of about that we've probably stopped noticing is the way that it has changed communities. I mean, I think people get very excited about where Collaborative falls short, but some of its strengths are legendary. And I mean, I know that the FMA was introducing people from a mental health background into co-mediation, you know, way back in the 80s. But I think that it was Collaborative that really boosted that. I know that occasionally people were using financial planners before 2003, but it was certainly Collaborative that kind of boosted that. And so what I saw happening in the sort of early noughties, not early noughties, in the noughties, was how it was really building these communities. And this bizarre requirement to live in a pod, whatever pod means, no one's ever worked out what a pod actually stands for, does actually bring people together to sort of recommit those or recreate those connections, even when it's not specifically for collaborative cases. We're sort of building and forging and affirming those links.
That's got to be a positive after the last couple of years, where I think all of us as family lawyers have realised how much we miss out on the camaraderie of the profession, because we as a profession are friendly, we like to catch up with people, and generally speaking, we tend to sort of, you know, operate on a positive level of communication. With everything being so separate and remote, I think that has to be a positive. Because obviously, from my perspective as a barrister, you know, my exposure to collaborative practice is fairly limited. But I do think that there are huge lessons to be learnt from the collaborative process that could make court proceedings, if that's the arena that you're in, much more effective and manageable for everybody. For example, I know we on Family Law Live, we have had was it Leslie on, who specialises in providing therapeutic and counselling support to people specifically going through the divorce process, so that we as practitioners know that our clients are in the right frame of mind to enter into these sorts of negotiations and make and commit to decisions that are going to have quite long lasting consequences for them. And again, independent financial advisors, I think, are really underused in court cases, where you're sort of just drawing very broad brush, you know, conclusions about whether or not your client can afford to live off this or that. And actually, there are so many things that seem to be sort of fairly standard and par for the course in a collaborative practice that I think would massively change court proceedings and improve them for the better for clients.
The difference, though, of course, is where the power lies. Mm. So in the court process, we're really being led by the legal experts as to where solution lies. And when we're in collaborative process, we're really supporting the clients to work out their answers.
And also where the suggestion comes from then in the court process, as you say, when it's being led by lawyers and you're naturally set up in an adversarial way from the start, you are always inclined to be suspicious of any sort of suggestion, to think that it's being done for a particular tactical advantage, whereas all of that sort of ulterior motive, I suppose, from what you've described, is stripped away, isn't it, in a sense?
This is where we're thinking that, I mean, do you think that no-fault divorce will lead to more collaborative practice because we're not trying to blame anybody, each other anymore, and we are trying to set off on that footing?
I mean, My answer to that would be, I think what will lead to more collaborative practice is more practitioners practicing collaboratively. I think it's as simple as that, which is what we're all about, you know, when we're trying to run these events and do lots of training. But it's how to get people interested, involved and excited about it. And I think the key does lie with us as lawyers to explain to our clients how successful this process can be. And of course, you can really only do that if you engage in the training, talk to colleagues and decide to kind of embrace it as part of your practice. It's never going to be all of your practice, but our goal is to try and help people make it a larger part of their practice, because many collaborative practitioners wish that it was. But I think that the no fault, I was at a seminar last week about this, where there's a concern raised that taking the fault out of the divorce process doesn't mean that it will go away, because there is a strong feeling among many clients, as we know, that there is fault attached to a divorce, particularly where there's adultery. So where is that going to go? And I think this, another strength of collaborative is that it offers a forum in which those emotions, concerns, fears can be explored, preferably with a family consultant. But even when you're having discussions around who's going to issue divorce, it contains those emotions and allows them to be aired. So I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, so in terms of, well, we might as well grasp the nettle on this. So one of the difficult parts of selling collab is the idea that you've got to change lawyers if it falls apart. So how can we sell this as a sort of positive experience and not, you know, because as lawyers, we tend to, you know, give those warnings, you know, in probably quite a scary way without even meaning to.
Yeah.
You know, because we have to cover ourselves, but I think probably the way that we deliver it could be done possibly better. What do you think,
James? Do you want to start on this?
Yes, because I'm going to ramble, and then you can jump in when you want to get out of my pain.
Expert.
I mean, I think it's slightly the equivalent of a question about how do you defend someone who you know is guilty, and to which Hannah would go, "Shut up! Such a stupid question." I mean, I think it's a little bit like going to see a lawyer and going on and on at the first meeting about the appeal from the final award. You kind of say, well, it's not really what's going to happen. And I flip-flap all the time. I mean, there are times when I've been quite fundamentalist about it and say, no, we must adhere to it every time. And there's sometimes when I've gone, see why we might not. See, when John Cornwell was inventing the SFLA, America had Stu Webb inventing collaborative, and they were kind of doing the same thing. And what's interesting about collab is that I think it's sort of culturally specific. And in the States, you've got a fused profession. So the solicitor then becomes the barrister, don't they? And I kind of understand that if someone has just been explaining their deepest, darkest secrets in what feels like a safe environment in a room, that to suddenly then be cross-examined and all of that stuff by the same person just seems absolutely extraordinary. So you'd never do it. So I kind of get why in America they were absolutely clear that it had to be there. I think we've adapted it, and I think we make sense of it. And I've done a couple of cases where the collaborative room, if you like, continues as this safe space, even though the parties have dropped out and gone into court process, because actually it's the collaborative opportunities there for them to come back to. And that's the way I think of it, really, is that it's there as a place to resolve things if you need to come back to it. And yes, we can present it as a absolute disaster, but that isn't the way I feel about it. And I don't feel it crops up very often. Aisling Collins on this call, showing off a little bit, I thought, just said she's just doing her first case that hasn't succeeded. Wow, I mean, she's been at it for, how long have you been at it? Anyway, forever. Doing quite a few of them. And so that's the first time that one's fallen over. So I worry that we give this piece disproportionate attention in favour or ignoring the strengths of the model. And I think it sort of still makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's it. That's it. Absolutely. You don't lead with the worst possible outcome, do you, in any conversation or in any sales pitch? If what you're wanting to do is work with these people in that way, you outline the benefits. And I think it's easier to do that once you've had experience. I know that lawyers who haven't done a lot of collaborative work express difficulty with explaining with any sort of confidence that it is going to work. So it's a case of kind of just grasping the challenge, and each new client that you see where you think it might be suitable, just giving it a go and describing it as a conversation rather than a process that we all have to commit to and sign up to, which may sound a bit scary. Actually, it's about talking to the clients about the fact that we're going to discuss things round table and bring in professionals and work constructively together. That kind of language, I think, is far more powerful than leading with, well, if this all goes wrong, you'll lose me as your lawyer. I never say that. I think you have to explain what could happen in the very unlikely event that the process doesn't result in a completed agreement. But I say things like, in that eventuality, which is unlikely, I have very good litigation colleagues who I would be able to refer you to. And I have had to do that in one case, as James said, in my time collaboratively. But you outline it as a very unlikely possibility.
Yeah, because if you're all going there with the right intentions, then why should it go that way? Yeah. I think Adele had something that she might want to say.
Sorry, I just wanted to say, you know, I think from an outsider's point of view, you know, what we've got going on here are huge shifts in narrative, you know, narrative of what you as lawyers know about divorce and how you are taught about family law, about the legal process and how divorce takes place. And also you've got your client's narrative, which is everything that they've picked up from their own experience, either as a child of separated parents, or maybe their friends have got divorced, what the media tell them. So we've got a huge shift in narrative when we're looking at collaborative, because we've got people coming into this, maybe not really knowing that much about it. And so, you know, it's important for some education to happen as well. And I think part of that is what we bring as other professionals, and certainly that I spend a lot of time looking at, well, what is blame? Blame is merely discharging anger and pain at just something that has happened. That is what blame is. So in a relationship, there's always more than one person. You know, we are responsible for what we contribute or don't contribute. And even, you know, when somebody has had an affair, affairs aren't necessarily, you know, a consequence of somebody wanting to end a relationship. Sometimes they are, but, you know, a lot of the time they're not. So there's a lot of new understanding that needs to come in here, because the clients we're working with, the only thing that has ended is their adult to adult relationship. If they have children, they are still a family. So it's helping clients to understand that what's going on emotionally for them is completely different from their responsibilities as parents, and to understand those two journeys that are going on. So, you know, there's so much to take on board here, and collaborative is so good for that, because you're working with family professionals who are wanting to work with the client's agenda, who are wanting to really look at this from a family point of view rather than what you want and what you want. You know, we're trying to see the family as a whole and lead them through this. That's all I wanted to say.
In terms of making it sort of, you know, part of the narrative, like obviously, you know, working, done a few cases with Hero and myself, it's the same thing I'd have thought for all of us, that we are now starting to have those conversations with clients as a matter of course of, this is what arbitration would look like. Do you want to consider this? This is what a private FDR would be compared to a court FDR as an alternative. Those are things that are now part and parcel of my communications and discussions with clients that weren't as necessarily standard even, what, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Because here, I think you know, you're saying that the options that you set out for clients and things now is much more expansive than just, you know, issue an application, off you go.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the problems I face with the collaborative work and getting that started is often the other side's already got a lawyer who isn't a collaborative practitioner, and they're not willing to change it, because I think, and perhaps they feel they'd be tricked into changing to another lawyer who is sort of on their spouse's side, and that can be one of the difficult things to get around. And I think there's not really very much coverage of it in the media. I think generally the public doesn't know that much about collaborative law. People seem to know about mediation, but not so much about collaborative law.
In terms of training as well, you have to make a business case for it, usually, for training. And we have to then say, look, if everybody was trained, then, you know, it would would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but I think that, I mean, I know that when I've explored it in the past, I've had, you know, management telling me, well, nobody does it anymore, it's not worth doing, you know, it's not a good business, you can't make a good business case for it. So,
you know, and you do have to, yeah, you do have to put time into marketing it at the beginning and time into getting to know the colleagues in your pod and training. But I think, you know, it's really worth doing, and it's a really good offering to have.
Just to come in on a few of those issues, I think what's often missed perhaps is that the pods themselves are a source of business referrals. You know, you are setting up cases with your colleagues, and so if you're asked to recommend someone, which I frequently am, you're putting together a shortlist, sometimes a very short list of one of a colleague that you want to work opposite, and then that spouse often goes off to that person and off you go. So I think that's perhaps missed in the way that we market it to those that have to finance the course. I mean, that's one point to make. But I think to your point, Hero, about the client who comes where the other lawyer is already instructed, I mean, it may not always get off the ground in that type of scenario, but there are still options to work collaboratively in the sense of a round table meeting and exploring and picking up the phone and using those techniques that we adopt in collaborative without necessarily signing up to a PA. You could still use those principles and apply them to the case if appropriate. But I think it's all about setting up the case, and I suppose trying to speak to your client first, if you can, about do they want to go this route, giving them the brochures, encouraging them to have the discussion with their spouse at home before anyone goes as far as instructing lawyers, if you can.
Definitely.
Go on, James.
Kirsty is bursting to say something of such staggering wisdom that we will literally have to end the evening right there.
Mic drop.
I was just going to make the controversial point, and I say this having been pod liaison officer for West Kent and East Sussex for, I realised the other day, almost 18 years, and having done several collaboratives with people that I know very well. But I do think we've debated so many times over the years, should we have to sign up to the participation agreement? And what we found in our pod is that actually sometimes you don't have to sign up at the first or even the second meeting. You can have minutes that record, the discussions are without prejudice, and you won't be bound by anything unless there are signed terms or agreed by all. And that actually, if you don't make it such a big issue about the heads of agreement, but say we will need to sign these if we're all committing to the collaborative process, it also enables in a case where I had one particular case where very early on we both the lawyers realized it wasn't going to be collaborative because of the husband's approach. But what ended up happening was we predicted this at the third meeting. Right at the start, he said, I'm not prepared to do this unless we agree this. We said, that's not collaborative. He went off, got a completely uncollaborative lawyer, went to court. I was able to act. He got indications at the FDR that he was wrong. Just before the final hearing, he got in touch with me and said, could I now appoint a collaborative lawyer? And he couldn't go back to the original person because of the way he behaved towards her. But actually, I contacted someone and said, look, it won't be proper collaboration because we've got court in 2 weeks. I'm not going to sign up. But we got round the table. We sorted something out. And all the hang up about signing the participation agreement, I think sometimes runs the risk of being for the lawyers, not the client's benefit.
It's interesting. I've just had one which should have been collaborative and ended up not being because they didn't want to go through the hassle of the participation agreement, or as Tasha would call it, the PA. And it's a shame in a way, because actually I love the document. You know, it's one of Angela Lake Carroll's productions again, I think, which is a thing of real beauty. You know, it's sort of terms of business, but it's written like, this is how it's going to be. I think it's really good. So I'm kicking myself on that because I think it's caused us real problems in the case, because the husband is now sort of really wanting reassurance that you can't actually give him on a round table meeting that we could have given him in a collaborative meeting because we'd all signed up to be doing this work together. Interesting, isn't it, how all these things throw up different scenarios. Thanks, Kirsty, then.
And the other thing we've developed in terms of the PA most recently is to give clients the option to have arbitration in there as a fallback option whereby they can keep their lawyers on side. So if the process doesn't result in that agreement, you can move on to arbitration seamlessly and still retain your lawyers. So sometimes that's suitable. In some cases, it's not for everyone, but it is something you can explain to clients who are particularly worried about this prospect of losing you as a lawyer. But, you know, as Kirsty said, there are so many flexible ways of applying these principles, and there isn't really a rigorous rule which you have to stick by. There's guidance and there are documents to help, but it is infinitely flexible, I would say.
Is this a terrible time to bring up the bad points?
The bad.
I feel bad because obviously we're looking at the positives. But yeah. can you tell us about the pitfalls and where the cases tend to go wrong? Because we do have to do the bad and the ugly, I'm afraid.
James, do you want to start?
I would love to start. That was my sort of thought whenever it was I wrote this. I think bad is probably where you try and reach out too far on the continuum. Pauline Tesler, who was doing the training back in 2003, 2005, would be very strong on the idea that actually collaborative could deal with almost anything. I'm not so convinced, and I think that when I'm starting out or brushing up, or when I was starting out, I think doing easy cases was much better. You know, I think probably collaborative is robust enough to deal with domestic abuse. I think it probably could be a very good way of sort of reinflating the victim survivor. I think I think it's amazing on complexity. Whenever I have, which isn't very often, very big money, I literally opt out. I say, well, this has got nothing to do with my skill set. This is all about risk profiles of the clients and their investment preferences, and I haven't got a clue. So I would then plug in a financial planner and really back out. I mean, I can divide 37 million by two, given a bit of time, but how you make up that half share, I don't think is our job. But actually put in the financial planner who's able to understand their risks and the investments and the tax options and all the rest of it. And I think you've got something quite quite exciting. So bad, I think, is where we reach too far. I also had a bad where you sort of get tricked, really, in that where, you know, because it's my mate who I really trust doing this case, that we step into collaborative on that one. And I sort of learned that lesson when I was trying to unpeel somebody's fingers from around my client's neck, just in the very early days of collaborative, you know, because it was Teresa Nichols down at Russell Cook. Of course, we'd be fine. No. So that's rather led me to wonder. I mean, we attended this amazing training from the Melka, which is the Melbourne bunch. And they would only really do intake with an Adele at the fore. So unless you've got a coach who has sort of worked out that this is the way to go, that you wouldn't get into the collaborative process. And I think there is, I think if you're going to do those tougher cases, that certainly a full team model or certainly having somebody from a mental health training background would be a good idea. So that's about avoiding the bad. And the bad is when you fail to spot it in time.
And another issue that's sometimes flagged up is what we call drift. So if the case doesn't kind of
proceed, I think that's ugly. You think it's bad. Case.
Oh, is it? it's shall I carry on?
Yes, definitely.
So this just came up in some of our discussions preparing for tonight, and what happens if the case kind of goes off track, as it were, because it is a voluntary structure and there has to be a degree of management, I think, by the parties sort of involved in the process. And I think my comment on this, because I have a case that's where this has happened recently, is that it's quite important to talk at the outset about expectations of timescales in managing your case. Because in the case I'm thinking of, one party had a very different expectation about how quickly this was going to go, and I think was possibly sold it on the basis that it would be very quick. Whereas the other party, who I was acting for, really wanted to take things at her own pace and really wanted to kind of adjust and accept the idea of separation divorce as things went along. So the parties have mismatched expectations. So I think the lesson there is, as lawyers, you do have to discuss timescales even at the outset, because one person's drift is another one's appropriate pace. And so it's just about mismatching.
What I would say in relation to that is I really think it's important in this session, as you say, that we are sort of quite, you know, promote the positives of collaborative practice. But speaking of which, if you're talking about drift, well, you say that's a bad or an ugly aspect of collaborative. It's inbuilt in the court process, drift, because of the amount of time you've got in between hearings. That drift is inherent. It's unless you're going to agree to go to a private FDR or arbitrate, where, again, you have got that power and control over the timetable, over the process and the procedure, and you can do it to suit you. Drift and litigation and correspondence and costs as a result are inevitably going to accrue because of the amount of time delay that you've got in between hearings because of the court's capacity to hear it.
Now, does Tasha think that she could create a new system of collaborative where you issue a few weeks into the process or someone else issues on the basis that the time between now, if we're talking about finances, between now and the first appointment is when you actually have to get on and settle this, and otherwise you're going to segue onto the new team. Tasha, what do you reckon?
I think we should all be doing that anyway, and we're probably not enough, but in terms of having that threat that otherwise you will lose your lawyer, it is a heavy one. Is that what you mean?
I wasn't really thinking of it as a thing. I was thinking of it as a practical thing where everyone says, OK, yes, we agree to do this relatively quickly. But I'm saying, well, OK, isn't 18 to 20 weeks going to be more than enough for that, for quickly to be completed? And if it isn't, we're going to need the court process. What we don't want to do is to try and do this, probably then to run over a bit, and then in 6 months' time be starting the process, which then starts our 20-week clock. I'm interested about how collaborative's quite versatile that way. So I'm just doing one again in the sort of hotbed of collab down in Brighton, where we're doing shuttle collab, which is I think kind of novel, isn't it? Because they're uncomfortable. One of them is uncomfortable to be in the room together. Mm. So they're we're going to and fro between the parties. So I think it's quite a versatile model, but I just think that might be one way of addressing
gift. What about a mandatory arbitration at the end if you can't?
I mean, you can build that into your process, Fiona. You can say, look, if we're just not reaching agreement, you could even build in timescales to your PA if you wanted to adapt it and say, look, we're going to try and resolve this within 6 months. Otherwise, we're going to instruct an arbitrator jointly, and you could pre-plan that. But I think the point is there are some clients who really don't want to go anywhere near a courtroom. And there's just enough to them. They want to do something else. And it's those ones that I think you have to talk to about timescales and case management regularly. So particularly the corporate type clients, they want to see that something's happening and the stay-at-home spouse perhaps isn't moving quickly enough. And that kind of scenario where you do have to just ensure you're delivering value for money. And I think forward movement on the case.
On money, we were going to talk about the ugly as being costs, but I don't know whether you want to, just with time, whether you want to talk about more positive things like what you can learn from being a collaborative practitioner, or do you have a burning desire to talk about costs, either of you?
I think it's important.
I'd love to talk about costs.
We've also not had many questions so far, so we've got plenty of time left, actually.
Right, well, let's talk about costs in that case.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that gets raised quite a lot as a, sometimes a critique, but strangely never in comparison to the costs of court proceedings, because that's really the obvious comparison, which perhaps James is going to talk about too. And I know James has done some costing models where he compares what this process might look like compared to contested litigation. But, you know, there are a lot of clients who come in with horror stories and they've heard court cases cost tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, and they just are horrified by it, and they definitely want to guarantee it's not going to be that, and it's not. But I do think you have to be realistic that it's only worthwhile where there are some assets to divide, or perhaps in a children case, the clients are willing to spend the money and obtain that value for money to build their future relationship as parents, for example, those type of cases.
I think Fiona's telling us to go quicker, so I'm going to try and be quick. I think with experts, you can be you can actually be more focused and therefore more useful. I do think there is this thing around the oral approach that one of our problems is that we're doing quite a lot talking it through in the meetings. And the bit I've been interested about I'll get rid of that now, is whether in fact instead of that we create a booklet, which I've written, but we might need to play around with a bit. So actually it's the workbook idea, that you are giving your clients a lot more information for them to work on in between meetings. And I think if we did that, then we would speed up the meetings and we'd actually be able to do more deeper work in the meetings themselves.
But I think I don't think you need to rush, James. But
I am a good rush.
The value, very often the value for the clients is talking in those meetings. And I think once the process gets going and they feel comfortable in it, it does become, as we've referred to earlier, a safe space. Mm. They can ask questions, have their concerns answered, and do that in an interactive way. And it is just universes apart from paying your solicitors to write reams and reams of nastiness in a letter, which they're just delighted to avoid.
And I'm very interested in listening to them. I think I'm less interested in them listening to me. So I think that if I can package more of what I'm going to say for some clients, not for all, into paperwork, so that I'm not going, well, I say get divorced, or this is one. You know, we're not doing the basics on sharing and needs in the meetings because they've actually read about it in advance. That might actually be a way of building the attraction of this model.
But a workbook would also give people structure. It would give them something to do. It might reduce anxiety because they're just working through a process that they can see. And I see a lot of benefits for that.
Yeah, and the upgrade on that is to recognise that we cause real problems with overload. So what I've been learning over the last few months is that I think one of the reasons why we can't get an Adele on every single collaborative case is that clients just go, whoa, way too much. You know, you've given me all these options and I'm telling me all these people I've got to appoint. And oh my God, this is a way of stopping it. Whereas actually, if we gave them the questions or if we gave them the information they need at the point they are to make the decisions they do need to make right now, I think we could reduce it, and then they go, oh, I see the point about that. Yeah, we need to have one of them.
I think you're right. I think you do have to keep it simple at the outset, James, and not give them too many options. Give them the
sound like you're telling me off.
They need. Don't sound like I'm telling you off at all. But I mean, one of the really powerful tools I think we use, we have all these little tricks and tools that you learn in your training, is the anchor statement, the power of the anchor statement. And some of the people I talk to use this technique where we give the client four or five questions and say, can you go away and think about these? And one of the questions is usually, why did you choose the collaborative process? Even before you've signed up to anything, this is way before the first meeting. And then they go away and think about it and always come up with really insightful points that are generally read out at the first meeting. So it's things like that, I think, that allow the clients to just think about, you know, why they're doing this and recognize the value in what they're doing.
I can imagine that's a really good sort of mindset and things like that. Can I ask you both what you learn from being a collaborative practitioner? Because I think some maybe more junior colleagues could be quite intimidated by the idea of sitting with your, but I think you raised some brilliant points, Tasha, about how it's really an opportunity for growth more than anything.
Yeah, I think it can be intimidating when you're first starting out, particularly. But I think as you go on and do more cases, and as James said, perhaps starting with the simpler cases that you might build up through building relationships with your pods, you can build confidence in terms of starting to work together with your counterpart to deliver similar advice sometimes, or perhaps discuss what you're going to say beforehand. So I think there are techniques that you can use to help with your confidence before going into a meeting. If you disagree with your collaborative counterpart, you know, the first time that can be scary, but you get the training whereby you're taught about the value of listening, the value of silence, reflection, acknowledgement, and all these psychological tools that Adele probably uses all the time, and trying to build those into your practice, not just collaboratively, but in other cases too, I think it's just hugely valuable. I think when I went on the collaborative course, it did change the way that I practiced law generally. And I think the other thing to say about it is that clients will benefit from seeing the lawyers working together and giving that advice openly. So it's an education, really, in terms of the way that things are conducted, but also the content of what you're saying to each other and how you explain legal concepts. Mm-hmm. They might, for example, understand the legal concept of needs or sharing, or whatever it might be, better from me than they do from their own lawyer, and vice versa. So you get those kind of synergies that happen in the room. So I think that the benefits, the learning opportunities are worth the risk or the challenges of maybe it being slightly difficult and challenging at first.
Yeah. James, have you got anything to add?
I'd have thought one of the big shifts is that you go from being this advocate who has to go in and dominate a conversation. I think that's how we conceive of law. And we move into, all we're trying to do is to understand what they're going on about. And that is so empowering. It's so much of a sort of more powerful and so much of a less stressful way of running a meeting is we're actually just trying to understand, so have I got this right? What you're telling me is this? No. Oh, I get it now. Okay, that's fine. So I love that. I think it changes a lot of how we think we have to be in meetings and how we deliver value to clients. I also think that collaborative forces you to go back to the fundamentals of what is this process that we're doing, which we haven't got time to look at the slide, what a shame. But I'm reminded that collaborative invented the private FDR, you know, because needs was, and that was what we did, and so we created it. And I think it generates different stuff because it forces you to think differently about what's happening. Mm-hmm. Oh, I also have to say, sorry, the Brighton questions are awesome, aren't they? So those are the questions which I think we can, you know, put into all of our cases. It's the stuff about what you're hoping to achieve, what's the best outcome you can hope for, what do you really want to avoid, what matters to you, all that sort of stuff. And then for those who went to the Jacinta Gallant training, you coalesce that into a question, which is sort of, how do we set things up between us so that we can move forward from this point, able to give of our best to the boys, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually use that in arbitration too, because what it does is you're saying to the clients, is this what we're trying to solve? So I had one where the father was very ill, the daughter had a life-threatening condition, they didn't have enough money to go around. And I was able to sort of hold them. This was actually in an arbitration rather than collab, but the same thing, the principle's the same. I was able to hold them to sort of solve this problem because it encompassed all they were trying to do. Mm. And that sort of idea is what comes out of this process. Too long, sorry.
Yeah. can I just ask, sort of coming to the close here, but just some of your sort of anecdotes, because I know Tasha's got a very funny one about one of her clients. So defining moments of your practice, please.
The ones that stick out, yeah. I mean, definitely, I think it's a process where it's context where emotions can come out and they can come to the fore, and this does provide some of the memorable moments, but it's also fantastically creative. So if you really can't think of what to do and you're really stuck, you're able to pause and go out and have thinking time and discuss and take 15 minute breaks or half an hour breaks or come back the next week. And the flexibility, I think, leads to creativity when you're trying to problem solve. So I had a case where we were trying to agree on a particular lump sum, what level it should be. And one of the parties was just refusing to leave the matrimonial home, did not want to go out and wanted to know what his interest was going to be before he moved out. And we were able to sort of come up with a staged or stepped approach where we said, well, if you move out in August, you'll get this amount. If you move out in September, you'll get less. And if you move out in October, you'll get even less. And guess what? He took the earliest possible opportunity and agreed to move out as soon as possible. So that was hugely, I think, satisfying and relief for the two parties. And the other one that comes to mind, which was also concerning a lump sum, and we just got stuck on this point, you know, and it was after several meetings and couldn't get to the right amount. And the wife who was involved just took a break, went outside and screamed as loudly as you can imagine, so that the whole office sat up like meerkats wondering what was going on. And she did have to take 15 minutes or so. There were lots of tears, but she came in back into the room and the husband agreed to a palatable lump sum to her. And you know, this is perhaps an illustration of how their relationship worked. It's perhaps a spillover from that, I don't know, but it worked and we were able to conclude something that they were both could make peace with and move forward.
That's why remote working works for me. I've definitely put myself on mute, gone out, screamed, and then come back into some sort of negotiation, I reckon.
Maybe you need to provide pillows so people can, you know.
You can't do that in the CFC. You can't just nip outside and have a good tantrum. Everyone can. And I'm saying that as the practitioner here, not even the client, but sometimes you have those days where actually a scream in the corridor wouldn't go amiss to me.
James, any screaming in the corridors from you?
Yeah, that's just me. I think my moment was the moment that actually I decided to go and capture this, because it was the late 90s and I went to see Jane Simpson, who was former chair of SFLA as it was, Resolution as is, in Manchies, which was the sort of nobility of family law. And Jane sort of started this meeting with a, well, what do you want? And I sort of mumbled something about, well, I thought we might sort of work things through and see what worked for these clients, because I've been a mediator for 10 years and I thought that seemed like a good way to go. And it, you know, it just sort of went on probably for the rest of the humiliating morning before I kind of had to pull back with something ridiculous. So then when Jane Craig, also of Manchies, also chair of Resolution, brought over these people, it was extraordinary, really. And for me, it was a light switch moment, that the idea that you could go into a meeting and you'd know what the ground rules were. So you'd actually understand the rules of the game before you started it. It's kind of completely obvious, really, but we don't have that luxury in roundtable meetings. You don't know what's going to happen when you go in there. In collaborative, you do. And so 800 invites later, I managed to pull to, I, sorry, too much me. Anyway, we got together 20 people, which was who we needed. And then we managed this. And that was the first training in 2003. And that was who was on it, really. And it was sort of exciting times, really. A couple of months later, we were all out in Vancouver being with a chant from a First Nation person. And, you know, it was sort of slightly rock stars, because it was the first time that anyone had come to join in this until then American movement. And then we sort of came back and suddenly it was catching on and it went everywhere. And I would love to get back to that place where there was this sort of real enthusiasm again. And my other sort of thought about it was, I went to do a talk about it in Germany at the start of Oktoberfest in a very scary hall in front of the Harvard Negotiation Project. And I remember trying to explain to this audience of Germans and Austrians why this bubble that I was floating above their heads was a perfect metaphor for collaborative. The idea being that it shifted with the sort of heat and motions of the culture over which it went. And they were just going, what are you talking about?
Did you have to dig that out of some sort of archive, James?
I am that sort of archive, yes.
I feel like I really missed out and I should have been there 19 years ago. Was it 19 years ago?
It would have gone so much better, Tasha.
You have to send me it so I can show Kim it, James.
One of just before we all leave, and I think this ties in with what we were going to cover anyway, one of the questions that has been shared is sort of people who are keen to learn more about collaborative law but struggling to find out details of training, what resources do they look at, what do they access? Thank you very much, obviously, to Ian's link that he shared that Dave's drawn attention to, which also, as Dave points out, is free of charge for those people who are struggling to sort of persuade about, you know, the value of getting it covered. But it might just be useful to say, you know, if people are looking to get into this, where do they start? Where can they go? What resources are available for them to look at? Who can they speak to?
Yeah, sure. Email me if you want to know anything. That's always fine. We're dealing with this all the time on the Collaborative Working Party. And what I can say is the Collaborative Foundation training is being looked at, being redesigned. So there should be more news on that later this year. Watch this space, kind of answer. But in the meantime, Collaborative Practice Forum, if you want to come along, just learn more about it in discussion format. It's twice a year. We're running them March and November at the moment, and it's open to anybody. Trained or not trained. So please do come along to that. We've also got an e-news about three or four times a year, which you can be on the mailing list for. So just email me again. I don't know if I should put my email in the chat, perhaps, but you can find me just Google and to find out more. But most importantly, I think just talk to people who do practice collaboratively in your firm, find out about it. And as soon as the resolution has got dates for the next course, that will come out obviously in the normal bulletins. But if you can build a case in the meantime, I know Tim Whitney and I did a seminar for young resolution bots on how to pitch this essentially to the people financing the course. So if you want to know any more information, I've got slides on that particular topic, and you know how to market the value of it essentially. Happy to help.
Thank you. Sorry, Hannah, you were going to close it there. So I think we're at time now, unless there are any more questions.
No, not that I can see.
Okay, well, thank you for all of our guests, and Adele, our unofficial guest, for giving us your insights, really interesting. But thanks to James and Tash, that was a really brilliant session, and I hope that this does inspire people to go forward and do the training. It definitely is for me. So yes, if you do have any questions, and I think James and Tash would be quite happy to answer them. Yeah. And yeah, everybody have a good evening. We'll be back next month.
Yes. See you soon, everyone.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Having us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.